Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery will take care of all your John Deere needs, from big tractors to little tractors to lawnmowers to riders to zero turns, implements, you name it. If it's green, they've got it up there. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, in the city of Shasta Lake. They've got some pretty good financing going on right now if you're interested in that. Or you can give them a call, and their phone number is 530-226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com, and that's papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! Deceptively simple, but often confused. All right. So our guest this hour is Dr. Judith Curry. She was with us the first hour, and if you missed that, the commercial-free archive will be up this afternoon. Today is October 1st, 2023, when we're airing this originally. And Dr. Curry is the president and co-founder of Climate Forecast Applications Network, CFAN. She's a professor emerita at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Let's see, I got to move this little icon here because I can't read it, where she served as chair of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences for 13 years. Her expertise is in climate dynamics, extreme weather, and prediction and predictability. She's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Geophysical Union. She has written a snazzy book that we have not had a chance to read yet, but we will. And we will talk about the book, or we'll force her to come on with us again just to talk about the book. That would be good. Climate Uncertainty and Risk, Rethinking Our Response. Huh, what a clever idea. And I think we'd be rethinking the response because, I don't know, she'd be looking at actual science. This show will be very confusing for all the global warming believers, but for all of us who have been marginalized as global warming deniers, we finally found someone that can explain why we think destroying the world to change the weather makes no sense. Like, thank God, at least somebody's finally piping up. Dr. Curry, are you all alone out there? I know there are others, but is it a lonely place out on the when you're forced to walk the plank and be the climate denier?
Not at all.
Nice.
Although I have to say, a lot of people have left their university positions because it's pretty hostile if you don't, if you have a different perspective. There are many who are in the private sector, who are in think tanks or non-governmental organizations, or who are retired or otherwise independent spokesperson. And through my blog, Climate Etc., I've developed a network of such people all over the world from many different professions, not just climate science, but lawyers, electric utilities, engineers, social psychologists, social scientists, economists, computer science experts, artificial intelligence people, you know, people from all over the world in the private sector, universities, and in non-governmental organizations. So there's quite a community of people out there with this perspective that UN officials, President Biden and most of the social media are trying to silence. God bless Elon Musk.
Yeah, no kidding. It's funny that you say that because I was looking at a couple of your Twitter posts and it's like, seriously, people, come on. You're a denier. Really? Is that what you, that's what you bring to the table? Like, and you're refuting her information based on, yes, nothing. So I'm kind of curious, why do you, it kind of seems like there might be more people, leaving the reservation, as they say, and diverging from the official narrative? What's driving it, do you think? Just frustration?
Frustration, their personal honesty and integrity. They don't want to play the game that you need to play in order to get ahead in university, academic life. And, you know, people who are concerned about the future and the way they see things going as we're destroying our energy infrastructure, destroying our economy and so forth and so on. And, you know, they're worried.
Yeah. They figured out they're going to live on the planet. They better, you know, they better make sure these guys don't implode it. The scary part of that, though, is as these people leave academia, I mean, on the one hand, I'm applauding. I'm thinking, good for you, you know, stick to the science and don't be controlled. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, oh, no. Now the only people teaching our students are guys who have swallowed this stuff hook, line, and sinker or are willing to just be, you know, amazing liars.
Well, and then also, too, if you look at all the peer-reviewed papers that are being written, this is who's writing them. And you can't get published in those papers unless you swallow
the
pill.
That's true, and they're peer-reviewing each other.
Toe the line.
Yeah, okay. Back in the 70s and 80s, there was no such thing as climate science or climate studies. I mean, if you were sort of interested in this, you would get your degree in atmospheric science, geology, or oceanography.
Okay.
You know, these are the hard sciences that help you understand how the climate system works. Okay, nowadays, you have, I mean, even in the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of programs in universities that are broadly defined as climate studies. And they're very soft core when it comes to the science. I mean, they're not learning any real climate science. They're learning how to recite IPCC talking points, and then they're learning about how to use climate models to spin alarming impacts. They're learning communications, politics and policy science, and there's very few places anymore where you can go to get a good, thorough foundation in the core sciences of atmospheric science, oceanography, and geology. So it's all being softened down in a rather ridiculous way. And
that'll hurt us long term too. I mean, obviously,
sure, and
creating a brain drain.
You've had activists, you know, going to get degrees, you know, in this topic, and then as they get tenure or whatever, they gain control, you know, and so you've got all this, right now you've got the whole academic community, and climate science, broadly defined, is filled with activists, and there was a survey, and this just blew me away. I read this maybe a month ago. There was a published survey of a bunch of academic people that worked in climate science, broadly defined. And about 70% were in favor of degrowth, not just green growth, but in favor of actual degrowth, you know, population reductions, you know, restrictions, wealth and what people could do, and they just wanted to see degrowth. And to me, that is absolutely astonishing, because the U.S. population is sort of 90% in favor of growth. You know, the degrowth growthers are quite a small number in terms of the overall U.S. population, but the degrowthers dominate the university. And I don't know how you get past this, because you've got this whole community of activist academic people that are teaching the next generation. And so how do you break that logjam? I don't know. You just need to make the field a lot smaller and stop funding it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, just stop the research grants and people will come to their senses. I don't know how you get out of that.
Yeah, stop feeding the beast. It will die.
to some extent, yeah.
Yeah. It's just got to be really disheartening as a scientist, honestly. I understand there's always, you know, there's always politics involved in all of these things because it's in everything. I mean, it's in family dynamics. It's in elementary school. I mean, that's not, it's not a new idea. But that seems to be really driving this. And it's fear and control, or control and fear. I'm not sure which comes first, probably the fear, I guess. When did that really become a thing? Like, when did that really sort of, when did you wake up and kind of go, hold on, when did we get this?
Okay, well, I looked into this, and I talk about this in part one of my book, Climate Uncertainty and Risk. Yes, go back to the 1980s and the UN Environmental Program. Again, and this is definitely a degrowth, anti-capitalist, anti-democratic organization, and they were, you know, looking for a cause that would help promote UN non-governmental control.
Huh.
They hate the oil industry and the fossil fuel industry. And so that they latched onto the climate change issue. Okay, this is our ticket. Okay, and it was, they set all this into play, and, you know, we're behind, you know, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Remember the 1992 treaty?
Oh, yeah.
Precautionary principle. This is what saved the day. We don't need scientific uncertainty. You know, if there's, you know, any conceivable threat, we can just go do this. You know, that was their rationale.
Wow.
So the precautionary principle was a big part of what drove this into, you know, international policy making. So it was, you know, a clear degrowth kind of political agenda. That was latched onto the climate change problem issue and used a precautionary principle to justify all this. Okay, this is absolutely stupid and naive basis for policymaking. Okay, but somehow it is still, you know, it's still carrying the day. All these targets and emissions and temperature targets are, you know, rationalized by the precautionary principle. But what my book does, and this is really in part three of the book, as it goes through and talks about what, you know, how should we think about the risks from climate change? And there are some, and there's benefits to climate change, but we need to be honest and clearly assess all this, and we need to consider plausible worst cases. We need to, you know, really understand the risks and the benefits in a rational way. And in terms of managing all this, you know, we can't control the climate. This whole idea of these targets and emissions targets and everything are based on the idea that we can control the climate. We can't. We need to disabuse ourselves of the notion that we can, that carbon dioxide is some kind of a climate control knob. It most definitely is not. Okay, so we need to, once we disabuse ourselves the notion that we can control it, then we have to figure out how to better understand it and how to manage the risks. Okay, so, you know, all of this is laid out in my book about how we should think about this and how we should approach this. And there's, you know, in 21st century risk science, there's a lot of good ideas and decision-making uncertainty. Lots of ideas and frameworks that aren't being brought to bear on the climate change problem. We're locked into this silliness with the targets, you know, and,
right,
you know, we have.
Until we've met the targets, we haven't done our job. Therefore, we can't mitigate any of this because we didn't hit our targets, even though the targets scientifically don't move the needle. This is like, it's a sad, defeating little loop.
Yeah. Now, there's another thing I have to point out, and maybe I should have made this point earlier, but a lot of the alarm is tied to an extreme emission scenario, the so-called 8.5 emission scenarios. And this is where you get, you know, all of the papers, you know, that say, you know, all these alarming impacts possible by 21, they're tied to this extreme emission scenario. And the IPCC, most of what they do is tied to this extreme emission scenario. Well, around 2016, 2013, I started reading some papers saying that these extreme emission scenarios are completely implausible. They rely on, you know, increasing our coal burning by 600%, you know, and stuff like that. It makes no sense. Okay. And, you know, and I was writing on this on my blog, you know, this is an implausible scenario, and people were publishing it, and I was trying to highlight these papers. You know, it was like screaming into the void. But someone was paying attention, because in 2021, the UN Conference of Parties, their, you know, annual, you know, report that they do, they dropped considerations of these extreme emission scenario, and we're working from the medium emission scenario. And this was done without any fanfare. And ever since then, you know, in the 2022 one, this was also dropped. So the UN has dropped consideration of these extreme emission scenarios. But even the sixth assessment report, the IPCC, relied heavily on these 8.5 scenarios, even though they mentioned a couple times that some people think these emission scenarios are implausible. Well, there's a long time horizon for these reports, so you can sort of understand that. But when it came to do the synthesis report, which was published in 20, or even just within the last year, they still relied heavily on these extreme 8.5 emission scenarios, which are totally implausible, if not impossible. So there's this huge time lag in terms of, now the UN is out in front of the IPCC in the right way in terms of saying, okay, these are stupid scenarios we need.
That's terrifying. The UN is going
to
save us.
Realistic one. Yeah. And
wow.
So the IPCC is off in la-la land, and scientific papers still continue to be published using these 8.5 emission scenarios, not just get published, but the mainstream media picks them up and hypes the alarm. You know, we're not going to have any water. We're going to have...
And that's where they're pushing all of this terrible policy. Oh my gosh! Okay, hold that thought. We've got more on this topic to discuss with Dr. Judith Curry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things. You won't see. Doing bad things to you. Mama always told me that I should play nice, but she didn't know you, and she gave me that advice. Yeah, I'm through with you. You want a bridge I'd like to burn. Scatter the ashes, smash the iron. I'm through with you. La-di-da. I don't want to be your just for fun. Don't want to be under your thumb. All I want.
little shout out to all the people who have left the evil climate change swirling suction of money and branched out on their own. So, Dr. Curry, before we bury the lead, it's not lucrative when you do that, though, is it? Like when you?
No. My company, among its clients, include some people in the energy sector, a number of electric utilities, and even two what I would call petroleum companies. Okay, and people say, oh my gosh, he's in the pay of fossil fuel. But they don't provide donations. I mean, I provide services to them, hurricane forecast, temperature forecast, wind energy forecast, so they can help make decisions about how much energy to allocate and how to prepare for severe weather, all this kind of thing.
Yeah, they're not like your new Santa.
Yeah, right. And the other thing is, in the private sector, I had a cushy salary when I was at Georgia Tech. And in the private sector, I have never come close to making what I did when I was at Georgia Tech. So I took a financial loss. You know, I'm doing fine, but I'm not making any money off of doing this or, you know, helping insurance companies and municipalities and, you know, energy companies make better decisions and better understand their weather and climate related risk. And when people say, oh, you shouldn't work for oil companies, you know, it's, excuse me, weather and climate information are a public good.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
You know, you should be providing it to every, don't you want the energy companies and electric utilities to have the best possible information to make their decisions? And what kind of advantage do you think they gain by using bad information
exactly.
and making bad decisions? So, you know, I find that whole canard really, you know, infuriating.
When you when you talk about hurricane predictions, recently we had a California-style hurricane that hit Southern California. there was all
this. Glad we weren't the only ones laughing.
Yeah, I mean, there was all this hype over we're going to get nailed by this massive hurricane. It's going to cause death and destruction. And, well, it never really happened. I mean, it was a bad storm, but it was a storm, for crying out loud. I'm sure the people on the East Coast were laughing their butts off at us because, I mean, they have serious hurricanes back there. Who do we listen to when it comes to these hurricane? Like right now, they've got hurricane warnings for the East Coast. They're predicting these hurricanes that are way out in the Atlantic coming on shore and wreaking havoc. Is there a place to go or somebody we should be listening to that has better information or more accurate information than what we're getting?
Okay. Ever since Hurricane Katrina, there's just been this extreme hype about hurricanes because people figure that people are more afraid of hurricanes than anything.
Oh, there you go.
You know, and
that's true.
Yeah, and so hurricanes get hyped in a crazy mm-hmm. way. But there's a number of people on Substack who are writing good newsletters about weather and particular hurricanes. Three that come immediately to mind are the Eyewall. Another one is Michael Lowry, and then Ryan Maui. I mean, these are three credible sources that you can, you know, get mostly for free, but if you, you know, pay a nominal fee, you can get additional information. But those are really good, credible sources, people who have advanced degrees in meteorology, really understand hurricanes and weather. I make specialized forecasts to my clients. I have about 100 people on my mailing list. These are paying customers of my clients. And what I bring to the table is I make better long-range forecasts and also more detailed landfall impact forecasts. So, you know, people on my mailing list are mostly people in the insurance sector, some in the energy sector, and even some in, like, building construction and more product, you know, project kind of management kind of thing. So there are sources out there that are very reliable. even like the Weather Channel, the Weather Channel is pretty reliable, but they hype it up a bit, but they're pretty reliable on the Weather Channel. Mm. So there is good information out there, but you know, there is tons of silliness in the media, particularly when it comes to a hurricane.
Boy, no kidding.
Yeah, I remember I had a meteorology professor back in the late 70s, and this poor guy, he's probably been institutionalized since. It was when the news was starting to blame the weather for things. It was kind of during that crossover period where this storm mm-hmm. killed all these people, you know, and this guy he would just lose his mind. He's like, the weather never attacked anyone. It's the weather. Like, he was super frustrated by the blaming of the weather for all these things. I'm hoping he's no longer living. He wouldn't be able to make it through this whole thing. Weather blaming.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, yeah, but it's every, you know, it's the heat wave, the cold wave.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
You know, and the severe convection. This year in the U.S., no fires, minimal hurricane damage. You know what the hurricane losses have been? It's been severe convective storms, thunderstorms, flash floods, tornadoes. You know, and this is the first time that insurance losses have ever been dominated by these severe convective storms. And the IPCC says, you know, we have no reason to expect severe convective storms to worsen as a result of global warming. In the U.S., you know, the frequency of tornadoes has actually declined significantly over a number of decades. But nevertheless, you see this hyped up as being caused by global warming. So it's just an all-purpose cause that gets, I guess, lots of clicks for the media, lots of media attention for scientists who think this somehow helps their career. And at the end of the day, we're not really figuring out how we can deal with these risks in a sensible way.
Sure.
My company just got a grant from the NOAA under the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR. Okay, the SBIR for companies does not have the political correctness concerns that the main, you know, government grants to universities does. So, you know, we have a grant working on figuring out how to use artificial intelligence to make better predictions of extreme weather events out to 6 days. So that's something that my company is working on, and we're very excited about this new project that the SBIR grant from NOAA is supporting. So stay tuned in a couple of years. Hopefully we will
nice.
See some better forecasts at longer time horizons.
Well, you know, you brought up all the insurance companies, and that's a big thing out here. I mean, we have lots of people who listen who don't live in California, but everybody has should be hearing because of our, you know, poor forest management out here. We've had a lot of really big fires that, of course, have been all attributed to global warming. And that has driven our insurance companies out of the state. That and some other bad policies
well, okay.
by the state.
Okay. Now, I testified earlier this year before the Senate Budget Committee on insurance and climate change. And I looked into particularly what's going on in California, Louisiana, and
Perfect.
Florida. I'm very familiar with Florida because Florida Citizens Insurance, they're one of my clients. Okay. And now, I looked at what California, and the big issue is the regulations on the insurance
yep.
industry. Okay, if you start capping what they can charge, then, you know, they're just going to pull out. Okay, if they charge what makes sense to them so they can stay in business, well, you have to pay. And, you know, year to year, they're going to go up and down as their perception of the risk, okay, changes. Now, in Florida, the issue is litigation, people suing the insurance companies. So the state is trying to get that under control, which will, you know, help the insurance companies. I think Florida's a little bit more friendly. But the point is, you know, there's all these new insurance mechanisms, insurance-linked securities, catastrophe bonds, all these mechanisms to help share risk, and they're great. Okay, but if the state governments start regulating all this, so the insurance companies don't want to play.
Yep.
Okay, so game over. Sorry, you're out of luck.
Yeah.
So you just need to let the market do its thing. And even, okay, I had a client, it was at one of the utilities in Florida, and they were trying to figure out the solar farms. We need insurance for our solar farms against hurricanes. And they tried, and the insurance companies were trying to charge them an arm and a leg. And they said, this doesn't make sense. So we did a study for them. You know, to show, well, this is what we think the real risk is to your solar farms. And they decided to self-insure. You know, the insurance companies were just charging too much. They had some misconceptions about, you know, what the real risk was to these solar farms. So they ended up self-insuring. We'll see if that turns out to be the right decision, but I definitely think it is. So, I mean, there's some interesting dynamics in play with regards to insurance. And like, all these new risk-sharing mechanisms that are coming online are really exciting and are going to help homeowners and property owners. But, okay, now, one person that I follow quite closely on this issue is an economist called Matthew Kahn. And his idea, if you get regions where there's a lot of risk, like, you know, Florida for hurricanes or California for fires, then it's going to make sense for investors to buy up a lot of properties, okay, and rent them out, and they can better figure out how to manage the financial risk and to make these properties more robust, you know, to whatever damage, and that it's going to be, you know, in these really vulnerable regions that you're going to see investors taking over the property and more rental, so the homeowners, you know, just don't have to deal with this whole issue of understanding the, you know, the hazard risk and making good decisions about insurance. And I think that probably makes a lot of sense as a way to proceed in really risky locations. But you just trying to regulate the insurance to keep prices down is not a good solution here.
No, they've driven them out. So between that and, well, and then you know, one of my pet peeves is that they consistently refer to our fires out here as natural disasters. Like, nope, those are policy disasters all day long. Those are not natural
exactly.
Natural disasters. Those are tornadoes and hurricanes and things we can't control.
Right. You know, when many of them are set by arson and they burn really badly because of poor forest management. It's really hard to call them natural disasters.
Well, and we get a lot of lightning. I mean, just up the farthest northern county in the center of the state that borders Oregon, I can't even. They had 26 fires all started in roughly the same 1 week period from lightning, and that wasn't even all the lightning strikes.
Wow.
So, you know, you get that in heavily forested areas and, you know, cut back on the management, make it a little harder to get to them, and you're going to have some fire. But this idea that if we all live in the dark ages, we will stop that just makes no sense whatsoever. And I know you had commented in one of the videos that I was watching last night. We were watching, you were talking about the environmental footprint of like wind and solar and kind of the viability of that as a, I don't know, you didn't say replacement, but as a substitute type of a thing to fossil fuels. And I wonder, when we come back, could we chat about that just a tiny bit?
Oh, for sure.
Because I thought your perspective on that was really smart, and it's one of those things I think a lot of us have thought, but
that's a hot topic.
But
though.
We don't have anybody with any credentials that goes, yeah, you know what, that actually isn't a dumb idea. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Judith Curry, and you are listening to us on We the People Radio.
.us.
What indeed? Well, you could listen to factual information. That would keep you from Maybe that would keep us from going crazy. Okay, so back to our topic at hand, Dr. Curry.
Okay, wind and solar. There's a whole lot of reasons. I'm not a fan of wind and solar farms. Rooftop solar is okay. Without going into detail, the push for wind and solar is the idea that they can be implemented rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we don't have to wait for new technology developments or the long time horizon that it takes to get a nuclear power plant in place. So the idea is wind and solar. It's free energy, you know, it's readily available, you know, let's go do it. Okay, a whole lot of reasons while that story doesn't quite work, but let's go back to the land use issue. The footprint, okay, if we were to replace all of our current fossil fuel usage generating with wind and solar power plants, it would use a huge amount of land, not just for the power generation, but for the transmission lines, because the wind and solar is, by definition, you know, it needs to be away from the population centers, and mostly in the Great Plains states, you need a lot of transmission lines. Now, if you talk about, you know, more than doubling the usage of electricity on the time scale of a few years, we need, you know, even more. People are unrealistic about how much energy we're going to need in the future. I mean, not just for developing world and to get electricity for Africa and stuff like that, but just in the United States. I mean, for things like, you know, huge data centers and artificial intelligence and blockchain and whatever, these things are using enormous amounts of electricity, and their benefits to us are just only starting to be realized. So we're going to need a lot more electricity, and the land use footprint is huge. And you say, you know, even the farmers, you say, well, you know, just put it on farmland. Well, the farmers don't want it, because if they, it reduces the value of their land if they ever decide to sell their farmland for property development or whatever, you know.
Yeah, and who wants shade over their crops and or dead birds littered everywhere? I mean, either one of them come with a big downside.
Well, not only that, but it changes the microclimate. Okay, it dries out the soil, and it warms the surface temperature at night. Okay, so it's changing the microclimate. So, you know, so farmers, you know, don't like it. And I don't know what the latest count, but the latest count that I've seen is that over 500 wind farm proposals have been rejected by some combination of the local communities, local landowners, and enviro advocacy groups. You know, they're just getting rejected. And the transmission line issue is, you think that, well, that should be the simplest, but it's pretty insurmountable. Getting new transmission lines built in the U.S., I mean, it's been, you know, for the last two decades, it's been creeping along extremely slowly. Okay, and the idea of having this national grid, you know, with lines going everywhere in the U.S. from the base region, you know, in the Great Plains state, you know, is just, you know, a pipe dream. It's hugely expensive, but again, getting people to agree to this who own the land is a very difficult thing to do. So they're talking about eminent domain and all this kind of stuff. Once we start going there, I mean, this country will be up in arms, you know, trying to claim people's land to support wind energy, which is completely inadequate and unreliable, and it turns out to be very expensive. You know, the other solution, you know, if net zero or reducing CO2 emissions, is really geothermal and nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, you can fit nuclear power plants right into the same locations where you currently have coal power plants, and you have the transmission and everything all right there. So it seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, but how's that going as far as an idea to pitch?
Oh yeah, no, it's growing. Nuclear is growing in support in leaps and bounds.
Nice.
Europeans, oh my gosh, you know, Japanese, South Koreans, Europeans, even in the U.S. I mean, this is where we're going. It's going to, in the U.S., the biggest problem is all the permitting and regulatory stuff. It takes forever to get these things built, and the expenses, almost an order of magnitude inflated owing to all the regulations. And these regulations need to be toned back because, you know, the new generation of nuclear power plants are so much safer and so much better designed that you just don't need all this crazy red tape. So hopefully that can get sorted out a bit. But in Japan and South Korea and Russia and China are building nuclear power plants like in 6 years. So it can be done. In the U.S., it can't be done within the current regulatory environment. The other thing that I see promise is geothermal energy, particularly in the U.S. West. And Colorado Governor Jared Polis is taking the lead in terms of coordinating with the other state governors to try to push these new technologies. I mean, this shows a lot of promise. Again, it's not as objectionable land use. It does take up some land. In my state, Nevada, Nevada Energy was looking to build a new geothermal power plant, but they ran into difficulties with the tribal land ownership, and so they have to find a new location. So they have to work around the tribal land constraints, either that or make it very lucrative, you know, for those who own the tribal land. So they said, oh, yeah, we want this. It doesn't damage the land very much, and we can make a lot of money. So they have to figure out how to deal with that. But this is even better than hydropower. You know, it's not intermittent. It's not asynchronous, unlike wind and solar. I mean, and so it's really friendly to the grid.
And it doesn't use a bunch of, with wind and solar, I mean, you just have so many problems. Yeah, there's nowhere to put the blades of the wind power, the turbines. After they get done chopping up the birds, you've got to figure out what to do with the blades because they're not recyclable.
I know. There's tons of problems. And the absolute worst is the offshore Atlantic wind turbines, and, you know, all the whales dying.
You know,
it's just unbelievable. And this is a kicker. In the 1970s, I mean, Greenpeace, you know, their big original mantra when they first came into business was save the whales.
Save the whales.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, who cares about the whales?
Yeah, they're silent on that issue now. Where's Greenpeace now?
Who cares about that? Well, same too with, I mean, for heaven's sakes, you know, endangered species are only impressive unless they want to, like up here where we are, they want to take out the four Klamath dams. And so they've got these endangered species that, 80% of the population lives behind the dams and the reservoirs. So the California legislature passed some legislation, said, well, they're not endangered during dam removal. So it's okay to kill them then. Like, what? You can't kill them any other time, but if we're going to take out all your dams, yeah, I guess we're going to kill them then.
Yeah. And so this is the problem, that the whole climate change activism has totally left traditional environmental issues behind. They're not important. You know, who cares about all this stuff if all of humanity's been destroyed or whatever, which is totally ridiculous. But, you know, the climate issue has displaced all of the traditional environmental concerns to the great detriment of our planet,
well,
in my opinion.
And I guess I'd even go farther. It's basically become a religion. I mean, in the absence of belief in a higher power, they have come to, you know, because, and you can tell by the verbiage, you know, don't you believe in climate change? It's like, no, I believe in God, but I'd like to follow science. I shouldn't have to believe in science. Science should be science. Like, I don't know when science started being a belief.
Jeez. There's a great new book out on that issue. I can't remember the title, but the author is Andy West. I think it's In the Grip of Culture, the Social Psychology of Climate Catastrophism.
Oh.
It's something like that. It's a really, really
good book. Not the second Great Witch Burning? Subtitle, right. A.K.A. The Second Great Witch Burning.
Right. So he explains, like, the cultural drivers behind all this. It's a pretty good book. But, yeah, no, it's crazy. And if people, you know, so I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so I'm about 10 years older than you are. And at the time, the scare thing was, you know, the Russians and nuclear war.
But, I remember
that. That was a little bit more of a real scare. Okay, so, you know, I don't know what hiding under our desks, you know, when a nuclear bomb exploded was really going to help. But we were all aware of it, and we were all scared. But that was a little bit more of a real issue than climate change. But you know, we eventually, you know, got over it and grew up. But what we're seeing with this climate issue is that it's just more long-term. And the messaging that goes out to children and young adults is far worse than, you know, what we see as adults even. Like, this book targeted at 4 to 8 year olds, Greta Thunberg's World.
Oh,
you know, why should Greta go to school when the world's going to end in 30 years? You know, all this kind of stuff. And this is fed to kids. And in curriculum in the U.S., you know, they're trying to turn all the students into climate activists. I mean, it's explicit in the National Education Association documents. I mean, it's just beyond crazy. So the kids are getting exposed to this. I mean, they're depressed, some even suicidal over this issue.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, all for what? They're living in the best of times. Okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, their future is very, very bright, you know, if they don't screw it up and if the adults in the room don't destroy the energy supply, you know, they're going to live.
Well,
you
if we know, put scientists, like if we put real science back in charge again and we start evaluating, remember we used to have to evaluate things, and now, no, you must believe it or you are, you know, a heretic, et cetera, et cetera. And Andy West's book, I'm going to post, I'll post that on the page for today. It's called The Grip of Culture, The Social Psychology of Climate Change Catastrophism. And he's Andy West, like the ordinal, W-E-S-T. But I'll post that on the page because, I mean, just looking at the picture on the front, it tells me everything about the book. It's like, oh, holy crap. That is exactly what they're doing too, and it's when you have to scare people. I guess I reject anything where somebody's going to come after me with fear. You know, you should be able to win me over on logic, but when you have to scare me to do it, I start going, I don't know. I mean, are a lot of people put off by the fright, or have we just scared people about so much stuff that now everybody just runs willy-nilly like sheep over the cliff?
Well, there's different personality types.
Oh, that's true.
That some are susceptible to this and others call BS on it. You know, so it's but the worst thing about it is trying to brainwash the kids. That's what I object to more than anything.
Yep. No, I would put in with you there because that kind of thing, and that never turns out good. That's the thing. When you manipulate people like that, as soon as they look at what's happening now, you know, we've manipulated people with so many things. COVID's a good one. Could you imagine if we really did have something that was super scary and gonna do everybody in, and everybody be like, oh, I'm calling BS on that one. We have to escape. Oh my gosh, I cannot believe it. How did this happen? We still have so many questions, so little time. But we expect you to be our hostage again in the future. We hope you had a fun time, because we have a whole list of questions, and I think we asked like three of them, and there's more. But
this was a great conversation, and you did ask really good questions.
Well,
and,
we're curious by nature, so you know we wanted to know. So we really appreciate you taking the time. We will have you on again. Hopefully soon. Our guest has been Dr. Judith Curry. You can find the archive later this afternoon at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, they say the sea is rising. Well, that's all right with me, 'cause there ain't no other place than on the sea I'd rather be. And that second coming's coming, it's right around the bend. And someday could be any day, and this world is gonna end, but that's alright, that's okay. There ain't nothing we can do about the whole thing anyway. It's a hang-on kind of ride. We're spinning through space and time, rocking this big old rock, just trying to have some fun. So let's drink another beer. Here's to another year. Let's take another crazy trip around the sun.